scripture reading is Matthew 5, verses 1 through 10. And seeing the multitudes, he went up into a mountain. And when he was set, his disciples came unto him. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs the kingdom of heaven.
Let's be thankful for this beautiful day, as was expressed in our prayers, for the beautiful singing, reading, for our elders here, men like Dean Sears. We have some godly men, and we're thankful for them. I wish you could watch them work together. It's a sight to behold, these men, as they carry out the business of the Lord's church, each expressing his opinion, is considered an opinion, and once the decision is made, if it be contrary to his opinion, you'll never know it, because he's right in there just as strongly supporting the contrary opinion as he would have supported his own. It's a real pleasure to work with these men. Brother Sears, we're thankful for you and for your godly life and for the good example that you leave all of us. We love you for your work's sake. In the week of December the 7th in 1971, it was my privilege to be a part of something really with which I had very little to do. A 77-year-old woman, alcoholic, had died. One of our elders, Brother Smith Howell, had become acquainted with this woman some 2 or 3 years earlier and had kind of followed her to see if he couldn't provide whatever needs she had. She, I guess, died in a drunken stupor. She was huddled in a doorway where she usually slept up in town on one of the streets. And she could be found at any time, perhaps, in the hallway of a rental apartment or of a row of tenement houses. This poor, friendless woman, no family, one night succumbed to death and was picked up by the authorities and taken to the morgue. This elder heard, saw in the paper that she had died, and he went to the authorities and asked, please, for her body. And they gave him the body of this woman. He went to the funeral home and asked for a casket, and they graciously gave us one. He then went to the cemetery and asked if they would let them have a plot of ground where she might be buried. And they graciously also gave us a plot of ground. Then Brother Howell came and asked me if I would be able to help in the ceremony or the funeral. And I was more than happy to, but it didn't require anything on my part. The point I'm making is that all these people who didn't even know the woman made efforts to show mercy to her and make provisions for her to have a decent burial. We look at that perhaps as not being too unusual, but at the time of Jesus Christ, that would have been far less likely to have happened. For Jesus Christ lived in a very cruel time. He lived in a time when his pronouncement upon the mercy, announcement of a blessing upon the merciful, was not in tune with the universal practice at all of that day. In fact, the Romans looked upon pity with contempt. The Stoics considered compassion to be a vice. Can you imagine that, living in a time like that? The oil of human kindness ran low in the vessel of humanity, and it seemed like that men were alpha number one to the extent that they would actually inflict injury upon others who were in the time of dire need. Juvenal, a historian of that day, wrote about masters who delight in the sound of cruel floggings, who revel in clanging chains, who are never happier than when they have summoned a torturer and can brand someone with a red-hot iron or steal the couple of towns. Another man, Seneca, who was a writer of that time, wrote and said, "Mad dogs, we knock in the head. We drown even children who at birth are weakly and abnormal. Infanticide was practiced freely, where they took little babies that were not wanted and just left them out on the mountainside for either exposure or wild animals to kill. And it seems that this was common practice. Today we find it hard to believe that that was done. Jesus lived in a time that was a very cruel age, and he did not speak, as I say, in tune with the universal practice. When Jesus Christ said, 'Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy,' though he did not speak in tune with the universal practice, he spoke in tune with the universal need. Because there's not a person here tonight, and there never has been a person who has ever lived, from the time that Jesus spoke that great truth until the present day, nor before that time, nor after today, will there ever be a person to live who at some time or other in his life does not need mercy. Though he didn't speak in terms and in tune with the universal practice, his attitude brought about a change in the practice. And because that mercy is a universal need, when Jesus Christ addressed himself to mercy and addressed himself and said that one of the characteristics of the kingdom of heaven is mercy, Jesus changed the course of human history and altered the human universal practice. I remember standing in the city of Acre in northern Israel in an edifice which was beautifully done. It was ancient, having been built perhaps 1,000 years earlier. And that edifice was a hospital. It was built by the Crusaders during the time when the Crusaders from Europe came into the country of Israel to run out the Muslim invaders. Wherever these Crusaders went, they always built these hospitals to care for not only their own ill and sick and wounded, but they cared for the ill and sick and the wounded of other people also, the people of whose lands they were now invaders in a sense. But these people were going about establishing these hospitals. And today, because of the influence of Jesus Christ, you have young people's homes, orphanages, you have old people's homes, you have rescue missions, you have so many acts of mercy and so many institutions that have been established out of recognition of the influence of Jesus Christ and out of recognition of this universal need of humanity. There never has been a person who at one time or other did not need mercy in some form or other. Blessed are the merciful has certainly had its mark upon the world. Has blessed are the merciful left his mark on you or not? Are you a merciful person? As you look at your own character, reflect just for a moment and look into the mirror of God's truth. Are you a merciful person? Perhaps not initially, perhaps not basically or inherently, but have you become a merciful person by having known Jesus Christ? I think it's interesting here to note that this particular beatitude, blessed are the merciful, comes immediately after the beatitude that says, blessed are those that hunger and thirst after righteousness. Do you see any connection there? As I was considering what was the next beatitude, and I should have remembered which was the next, but I couldn't think right offhand, and I began to think, I wonder if it is blessed are the merciful. And I went to my Bible quickly and I read it, and sure enough, there it was, following close on the heels of blessed are those that hunger and thirst after righteousness. But what's the message? The message is simply this. It is as though Jesus Christ were saying, now that you've come to hunger and thirst after right, now that you've come to want to do right, be careful lest you look down your nose with contempt at those people who haven't come that far yet. And I just nearly laughed out loud when I saw the wisdom of God and the tremendous wisdom of the Lord Jesus Christ as he here tempers justice or judgment with mercy. It's as though you were writing what James says, that mercy glories against judgment. And it's as though he were here giving us a little warning. Be sure to temper your judgments with mercy. Aren't you glad he wrote it like that? Aren't you glad he didn't just leave it blessed to those that hunger and thirst after righteousness? Because it's so easy. It's so very easy to be converted. And we'll use that in quotation marks. It's so easy to be converted and yet carry with us the same harsh, unyielding, hard line toward other people. While we're in the world, we have certain motives for being hard and harsh and unyielding. We have certain base motives and ulterior motives. We have certain reasons, we think, and they're usually self-centered for being like that. And so we have a group of people that against whom we unleash all of our harshness and bitterness and resentment. And we do this in a selfish, a heathenish way. But then having become converted, are we not awfully prone to bringing with us those same harshnesses, those same bitternesses, those same animosities? And yet while having been converted, we disguise those animosities under the garment of righteousness. And yet we just kind of shift our animosities from one group of people to another group of people, and we keep on being hard and harsh and unyielding and unmerciful. I think that it's possible, and I think that really this is why Jesus Christ places this right after he says, blessed are those that hunger and thirst after righteousness. It's so much a tendency that the little girl prayed, oh God, make all the bad people good, and please make all the good people nice. Because not all good people are nice. There are a lot of good people who have achieved a level of morality that is void of any mercy to anyone who has not achieved that same level of morality. There are a lot of preachers who, if the attitudes of their preaching could be translated into first century heathen, those preachers would very much resemble these masters of whom Juvenal wrote when he said they delight in the sound of cruel floggings. They revel in the clanging chains. They're never happier than when they have summoned a torturer and can brand someone with a red-hot iron for stealing a couple of towels. Did you ever hear anyone preach who had that attitude toward people? Who stand forth and denounce sin in such a rigorous manner that it seems like they're condemning people to hell and they're really glad that they're going there? Well, that's not what Christ had in mind when he talked about our life in him as a Christian. Well, what is mercy? We're going to note it just very briefly. And to find out whether or not you have become affected by this principle that Jesus states here. Are you a merciful person? You say, well, I haven't built any hospitals. I haven't done a lot of things perhaps that you consider merciful. But I'm not talking about those things. There are 101,000 ways that you can show mercy to people that indicates that you've been influenced by this principle of Jesus Christ. Mercy, for one thing, that it is not moral vacillation. You know, there are a lot of people today, and our young people are being subjected to such an influence that they would come up with the attitude, oh, well, don't ever criticize anybody for anything. Let everybody do his own thing, and just don't ever condemn or criticize, and don't ever say that anything is right or wrong. I don't believe that that's what Jesus Christ meant when he said, blessed are the merciful. I don't think he had in mind moral vacillation that is afraid to identify right and wrong, and thus becomes kind of a sidestepping philosophy by which we ignore or overlook or never rebuke or never criticize or never discipline. I don't believe that that's what he meant by mercy. Now, there may be those who think that it is. There may be those who think that many things are merciful that we wouldn't agree with. But what I'm simply saying here is that mercy is not moral vacillation. It is not ethical bankruptcy that causes us to be unwilling to say that this is right or this is wrong, for fear of upsetting someone or overturning the boat or rocking the boat. That's not what he means by mercy. Mercy is not just looking the other way, you know, and ignoring what is wrong. Mercy is not just throwing up your hands and saying, oh, well, what's the use? Who can do anything with these teenagers anyway? And going on and never taking a corrective hand or never applying discipline. That's not mercy. That's cowardice. That's moral vacillation, and that's not what I'm talking about. Mercy also is more than just pity. What do you think about pity? Do you have any basic feeling about it? What is it? Is pity mercy? Well, it's involved in it, but mercy is much more than pity. I think, Frank, that pity is a cop-out. I think that pity is a very easy escape route that we can take in order to get away from showing mercy. I find myself dropping into this thing to where I become pitiful toward people, but I don't become merciful toward them. For example, one day a man brought his little son to Jesus, and on the way there, this young man fell down in the dust, began to wallow, and began to foam at the mouth, and went through all these contortions and the rigidity that goes with a seizure. And sometimes, his father says, throws him into the water. And while he was describing it, it happened to this boy. And no doubt all of the people there who watched were moved to pity. And they must have thought, oh, those pitiful, that pitiful boy, those pitiful parents, and what they've had to put up with in this boy and caring for him and all. It's pitiful. Well, that's true. But Jesus, you see, he wasn't talking about pity here. And neither did the father of this boy come asking for pity. He could find plenty of pity in the world. What he wanted was mercy. When the men in Luke the 17th chapter came, the 10 lepers who smelled so terrible, who dressed so awful, and whose body was so racked with this terrible emaciating disease, perhaps their nose bleeding all eaten off, perhaps their lips were all gone, their skin was hanging to the bone. All of this and the smell of them was terrible. No doubt it must have evoked pity in the minds of those people who watched them draw near to Jesus. They wouldn't come really near to him. It says they stood afar off, but they were wanting to come near. No doubt people looked at them in pity. No doubt Jesus Christ did too, but they were wanting mercy. They cried out, "Have mercy upon us." Jesus gave them more than just pity. Jesus Christ healed them and sent them on their way. That's what they were needing. They needed mercy. No, pity alone is not enough. Mercy is something more than that. Mercy, you might say, is compassion of soul, whereby one person is moved to action in relieving the misery of another person. That's mercy. Mercy is pity with hands and feet attached to it. Mercy is compassion with skin around it. Mercy is sympathy in gear. Mercy is all of these attributes and all of these attitudes and all of these emotions of a tender heart put into action by the hands and the feet that belong to that tender heart, to where the person who is in such a pitiful condition is the recipient of a good deed that relieves his misery. This is what mercy is. Are you a merciful person? Do you find yourself being genuinely moved to action whenever someone's plight becomes known to you, so that you become someone who benefits the other person? Are you a merciful person or not? Brethren, you'll never get to heaven. Will not any of us get to heaven without being a merciful person? Well, what all does it involve? It involves one very simple principle, and it's found in Matthew the 7th chapter, verse 12, where Jesus said, "As you would therefore that men should do to you, do ye even so to them." This is mercy, in the sense that this is a reciprocal blessing or a reciprocal beatitude. You spoke of it as being a reciprocal beatitude, Jimmy, and it is. This is the beatitude that says that as you would have men do unto you, you do so to them. But it's also saying that blessed are the merciful, for they'll receive mercy. This is the only beatitude that's like that. It's the only beatitude that says you give this and you'll receive it again. And perhaps there's some reasons I hadn't thought about it until today. But it's true. This one says blessed are those that are merciful. They're going to receive mercy. You're going to get what you give. You're going to receive what you give. So it is here. But it involves putting yourself in the shoes of another person. You know, I don't think there can be a real understanding of another person's need until you put yourself into that person's shoes. Empathy, the extension of your own personality, or the extension of your own consciousness into the framework of the other person's life. I can't understand drunkenness. I cannot understand alcoholism. But there are those of you who can, because you've worked enough with them that you've seen the misery. And I've worked enough with them, but I still can't understand it. I cannot understand a lot of things. But until I've been able, at least, and willing to inject myself and to project myself into their shoes, I'll never really and truly be merciful to them. There are about three things, and there are many more things, I'm sure. I want to mention three things for your observation tonight. Three practical ways that being merciful affects us and the results of this effect that it has in our life. One, being merciful will make you generous in your judgments of other people? Are you generous in your judgments of other people? Or are you suspicious, and do you always look for the worst in them? Being generous in our judgments will not condemn the guiltless. I wonder how many people who've been completely innocent in something have been judged as being guilty by someone who didn't have any mercy in his makeup. For example, in Matthew 12, chapter, Jesus' disciples were going to a grain field one day. It was a Saturday, a Sabbath. And the disciples were hungry, so they rubbed these grains in their hands, blew away the husks, and began to eat those grains. The Pharisees were up on the mountain with the binoculars, watching every move that they were making, because they were looking for something, you know, to trap Jesus with, and to get him where they could condemn him. And so here they came running and saying, "Aha! Your disciples are doing things that it's not lawful to do on the Sabbath day. Why don't they do what's right?" Jesus said, "If you only knew what this meant, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you wouldn't have condemned the guiltless." But because they had no mercy in their makeup, they weren't looking for what was good in people. Had they been looking for what was good in Jesus Christ, they would have seen the same thing in him that they saw in David, whom they considered to be their friend. Jesus points it out. He says, "Don't you know what David did when he went to the temple in the days of Abiathar the high priest? And he took the showbread and ate it and gave it to those men that were with him. Don't you remember that?" As though to say, "Don't you know, you approve what they did, and yet you condemn what I do." And here's the principle. These men became inconsistent with themselves because of the fact that mercy made them approve that which their friends did and disapprove that which their enemies did. And it's the same thing. And yet that's what lack of mercy will do. It will make you inconsistent. It will make you approve of the thing that people you like do. And yet people that you don't like, they may do the same thing, and you'll disapprove of that. Why are we like that? Well, because of the fact that our judgments are not tempered with mercy. We find ourselves unable to be consistent because of the fact that we just aren't willing to judge in mercy. Look again. What if a person is guilty? What if a person is really and truly guilty? What will mercy make you do there? Mercy will make you give him a second chance. In John, the 8th chapter, verses 1 through 11, when Jesus was brought, this woman taken in adultery, and they threw her in the midst. You know what said? This woman was caught in the act of adultery. The law says, "Stone her." What do you say? Here they stood, you know, unflinching, unyielding, unmerciful. Jesus, and you know the story, how he said to her, essentially, "Go your way and don't sin anymore." But watch what happened. We find these men becoming inconsistent, or we find their inconsistency being brought out into the open. They were inconsistent in this respect. Jesus asked them this simple question: "Which of you, or let him that is without sin among you cast the first stone?" And then these men began to look at their own lives and see perhaps they were guilty of the very same sin this woman was guilty of. But you know what was the problem? They were willing to excuse in themselves what they were unwilling to excuse in other people. And they criticized and condemned what they saw in someone else that they really and truly allowed to exist in their own lives. Have you ever done that? Have you ever been so willing to condemn in other people that which really in your own life you accept and you tolerate? I know you do it. I do it too, and I find it one of the hardest things to do is to recognize in my own life the very things that I'm condemning in the lives of other people. Mercy looks for a way to forgive. Lord Jesus could have condemned this woman. But mercy looks for a way. And Jesus found that by taking this rebuke upon himself, and he let them perhaps think that he didn't even know the answer as he scribbled around and dallied around and as he, you know, played for time. Perhaps he even gave that price and said, "I'll pay that." But he looked for a way to forgive this woman, where lack of mercy looks for a way to condemn. Jesus Christ says, "In your judgments of other people, be careful the way you judge them. Judge not that you be not judged. For with the judgment that you judge, you're going to be judged. And with the measure that you meet, it's going to be measured to you again." Matthew, the 7th chapter, is simply an elaboration in a negative manner on this thing of being, merciful and then thus receiving mercy. You see, mercy is kind of like an incubator that lets people grow up and blossom all they bloom. And the finest colors and all that's good in them just comes forth once they come into an atmosphere of positiveness, an atmosphere of positive goodness that's been created because the person in his mind says, "I want to do the very best for you, and I'm going to put the best construction on everything that you say, and I have confidence in you. Come on, I know you can do it. And if you stumble, that's all right. Get up. Come on. You watch a child grow up in that kind of an atmosphere, and you watch him as he grows into manhood and see what kind of a man he becomes. And then contrast that kind of an attitude with the child who has grown up in this kind of an attitude here, where the mother and father are suspicious, and they're always downing him, and they're always against him, and they never praise him, they never give him a second chance, they're always at him. You watch the difference in those two boys, and you'll see why Jesus Christ said, blessed are the merciful. Well, there's a second principle, that is forgiving when we've been offended. Being generous in our judgments of other people, mercy will make you do that. Mercy will also make you forgive once you've been offended. How do you act toward people who've offended you? Let me give you a good test. How do you feel when all of a sudden you find yourself in power over someone who has offended you? In the recent war between the Israelis and the Egyptians, when the Egyptian army, the third army, I think, was caught over on the east side of the Jordan, or the east side of the Suez Canal, and they were there encircled by the Israeli army. You know what some of the Israeli people said? They were incensed because others allowed food and water to be sent in. These people now found themselves all of a sudden in a position of power over those people who had offended them. And they responded like worms. They said, let them die. Let them die. Well, that's not unusual for the world. But Jesus Christ would not have said that. He would have said, feed them. If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. This is the principle here. Be merciful, and you'll receive mercy. And I'll tell you one thing. If you want to know how to be hanged at dawn, go around hanging everybody else at dawn the minute they make a mistake. And boy, don't think they won't jump on you like a duck on a June bug the minute you stump your toe. Here they're going to be after you just as quick. You won't know what happened. They're going to do you like to do the chicken. You know, a chicken, if he ever gets a spot of blood on it, you know what happens? The other chickens will just peck him to death. They'll kill him. Because they don't understand this principle of showing mercy. And they just simply are out after each other constantly. Well, you can't do that if you expect to be Christ-like. Forgiving when we've been offended. What do you do when misunderstandings occur in your family? Are you receptive to overtures? Are you receptive to overtures of reconciliation? When the husband has offended you and he comes and says, let's not be like this, how do you treat him? Huh? How do you treat him? Do you say, uh-huh, yeah. Yeah, it's a fine time now for you to be talking like that. Why did you talk like that 3 or 4 days ago? More than that, not only are you responsive to overtures of reconciliation, but do you ever initiate such overtures? Do you ever initiate such reconciliation? Now, in every family, pretty well, there is an initiator and a reciprocator. You didn't know that, did you? Did you? One or the other. Did you know, are you the initiator or are you the reciprocator? Well, but I was in the right and he was in the wrong. That had nothing to do with it. In Matthew, the 5th chapter, and verse 22 and 23, and in Matthew, the 18th chapter, Jesus Christ says, whether you are the offender or the offended, you're supposed to go and be reconciled to your brother. That's beautiful, you know it? In Matthew 5, he says, if you know that your brother has something against you, in other words, you've been the offender, he says, goodness sake, go to him and be reconciled, and then come over you again. But in Matthew, the 18th chapter, he says, if your brother has been the offender, if he's the one that's offended you, you go to your brother and be the party that initiates this reconciliation. So he simply says, there is no such thing as sitting back in sullenness and waiting while the other person stews in his own juice. He said, that's not Christian. Did you ever hear of the perfect murder? The woman who stabbed her husband to death with an icicle. There was no weapon. They couldn't find a weapon. She just ran him through with an icicle and killed him. And then the icicle melted. And it evaporated by the time they found him. They found this huge hole in him, but there was no weapon. She went off scot-free, I guess. You know, a lot of marriages have been killed like that. The ice-cold shoulder of a husband or a wife has killed many a marriage. You don't have to curse and swear at him. You don't have to become violent. You don't have to become vehement. Just freeze him out. Just sit there in sullen silence for days and watch this thing cake up and just begin to drift ice and watch it as it begins to thicken to where it's such a fog you can't get around in the house. Oh, that happens sometimes. You young ladies, if you ever get one of these boys to propose to you, make up your mind that you're not going to live your life in sullen silence. And you boys, if you ever marry one of these girls, don't you let a night go by without having gone to her and saying, "Honey, I'm sorry. I was stupid. It was a blind blunder on my part, and I'm just sorry." Don't let the sun go down on your wrath. But you're going to have to be merciful if you're able to overcome these hurt times and are able to forgive when you've been offended. But how about being compassionate on those whom you find to be in misery or in hard times, especially people that you think don't count? How do you treat people that you think don't count? The rich man and Lazarus. The rich man treated Lazarus in a way of just sheer contempt. He just ignored him because what could Lazarus count? Here was this man with all these riches. Here was this man with all these sores. How could the man with all the sores affect the man with all the riches? And so the rich man just said, "Well, get away." Have you ever met anybody like that? I want you to think for just a moment. In the heart and in the life of every one of you here, you young people, there's some teacher on campus that you just think just doesn't have it. He's just not with it. He's boring. He's dull. He absolutely infuriates you. Just gets sick of being in his class. I want you to think about that person and visualize him in your mind right now. You got it? There's one over there, I'm sure, that you don't think has any business being there. And whether he has any business being there is another matter, but you think that you know more than he does, and you think that he's not really worthy of being there. Think about it just a moment now. How merciful are you to him? Or do you run him ragged? Or do you treat him like that chicken that has a blood spot on it and you just peck him to death? Do you act in such a way that no human being on the face of the earth would act that way in his right mind? You know why you act like that? Because you think he really doesn't matter. You look upon him with disdain, and you look down your nose at him, and you think, "Well, you just are nothing as far as I'm concerned." So you treat him like that. Did you ever get a ticket from one of these security officers? Who is a security officer? He can't put you in jail, can he? Dr. Gaines, can they put you in jail? I didn't think they could. I didn't know the first service. I thought I got called out. I don't think they can put you in jail. Well, do they hand out grades? No. Well, then who are they? Well, they're men trying to do a job. Are you nice to them? Are you merciful to them or not? You know, they're human beings. They have needs. They have a need for someone to love and be friends with them. Don't look down your nose at them. They don't really matter as far as your grades are concerned, as far as you're being put in jail, or as far as 101 other things. They're not really all that important. But they're human beings doing a job. Be merciful to them. And you can test or check whether or not you're a merciful person by the way you treat some of these people that you consider really to not be all that important in the overall picture when no one is watching. How do you act toward them when no one is watching? How do you act toward those people who serve in the cafeterias? Some of these people aren't even Christians. Do you treat them in mercy? Or do you treat them with contempt and scorn? Do you let them know, "I'm not merciful to you. You don't really count to me"? Well, the way you treat people that you consider really not important determines or is an indication whether or not you're a merciful person. Whereas this man, the rich man of Lazarus, whereas he was condemned for not showing mercy to one who was insignificant to him, the Good Samaritan has been immortalized for 1900 years because he showed mercy to someone that was a stranger to him and someone really held him in contempt. He was actually showing mercy to one of his enemies, and he's been immortalized for it. The scene in Matthew, the 25th chapter, where it talks about those who were sick, those who were hungry, those who were naked, those who were in prison. You know, we visualize that scene as being applicable only to those people who are in need of physical food or physical drink or physical clothing and warmth or physical housing other than a prison. Did you ever think that those people standing there on that left-hand side of the Lord may be young people who showed contempt to a teacher or young people who showed disrespect for someone they considered less important than they perhaps were? And that maybe the man standing there, all he needed from you was just simply a kind word, just simply a merciful gesture to where you put your arm around him more or less and said, "You're important to me and I love you, and I'll treat you just like I would treat anybody. You're just as good as I am, and I'll treat you as kindly as I can." And it may be that you'll be kept out of the kingdom for having shown a lack of mercy in your attitude toward people that you consider to be less important than you should consider to be. You know, it's possible to feel pity for the world in general and yet contempt for individuals in particular. After you have looked and been generous in your judgments of others, after having forgiven when you've been offended, after being compassionate on those who are in misery, let me warn you against one thing that's liable to catch you off guard. Sometimes this happens. Just this very day, it caught me off guard after preparing on this during the week. I told James Burdo, I told him today, I leaned over to him, I said, James, I'm going to wring your neck if you ever speak out against the public assembly. Bless his old heart, the blind man that keeps talking out, you know it. He said, hey, you know, he couldn't hear me. I said, I'm going to wring your neck if you don't quit talking out in the assembly. He had a kind of a laugh over it, but you know, I was halfway serious. Not until I was sitting up here on the podium for the first service did it dawn on me. Thou hypocrite, you've done the same thing you're going to tell these people not to do. I don't know how else I could have told him. I think perhaps he needs to be told, but I think I could have figured out a better way to do it if I'd just been a bit more merciful. Sometimes we're merciful to people in general, and then we're very obnoxious to those people in particular. You know, wasn't it Peanuts that said, I love humanity, it's these people I can't stand. Someone said of a woman, a near relative of mine, she sure loves the church. It's the members she can't stand. You remember when Jesus Christ was dying on the cross and was there dying for the sins of the world? Oh, how easy it would have been for Jesus Christ to have got lost in this illusion of grandeur. I'm dying for the sins of the whole world. All of a sudden, there was this little fellow pulling on his and saying, Jesus, remember me when you come in your kingdom. The world was there. Why was a thief? How easy it would have been for Jesus to have said, look, don't bother me right now. Can't you see I'm here dying for the sins of the world? Leave me alone. But he was one of the world. And I think one of the most graphic descriptions to me of the divinity of Jesus and of the genuineness of that great man was the fact that while he was dying for the sins of the world in general, he had the grace to turn and say to this man in particular, it's all right, today you're going to be with me in paradise. That's the most beautiful quality I think I've ever seen. It's the thing in the gospel that hooks me. I can't get away from it. I think I could walk away from this concept of Jesus dying for the sins of the world. I can't grasp that. But when I see this one dying for the sins of the world turn to this one who was a thief, who could contribute not one single thing to the kingdom of God, to its ongoing, he wasn't going to be alive 5 minutes longer, perhaps. When I see the great King of glory turn to this one person who was nothing and say to him, today you're going to be with me in paradise and extend it to this person. I can't get away from that. That's great. It's beautiful. That's the gospel. Are you a merciful person? As you go out of here today, you see the people on the street, you see the caretakers, you see the teachers who are in need of someone encouraging them. Oh, listen, don't let them pass you by, and don't pass by them without extending a hand of gratitude or extending a gesture of mercy and letting them know that you love them and that you're going to have to count on their being merciful to you also. Because there's never been a person who at some time or other in his life does not need mercy extended to him. That person may be like the rich man in Lazarus. He may be the reason why you will get into heaven or will be barred from heaven. Do you remember the day I needed you and you just simply said, go away, I don't want you? That may be what keeps you out. On the other hand, Jesus said, blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. It's a beautiful quality. I hope and pray that you be a merciful person. You won't get to heaven, I think, without it. Nor will I. May God grant us this grace. Jesus walked in our steps. He walked in our shoes. He turned and gave us mercy. And has become a merciful high priest to whom we can flee in the time of need. Receive mercy to help us. Aren't you glad that you can be a Christian? Aren't you thankful that you are a Christian? What a wonderful Lord. May God bless us. Love Him more every day. Yield yourself to Him. Surrender yourself to Him. Let these great attributes and qualities that belong to Him, let them become part and parcel of your own life. You'll become more like Him every day. You'll be the kind of person God wants you to be, that you were created to be. you like to respond to the gospel tonight in whatever way you may need, become a Christian, or to yield yourself again and surrender and start over, whatever may be your need, would you come up, stand and sing?